This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Today on Sticks In, we are talking all things from the opening weekend of the Premier Lacrosse League season. Week one in the books, they played it up at Albany. We had four games. We had some really exceptional individual performances. We had some great games themselves. We had team results. We had some surprises. We had some big news. All sorts of things happened in week one, so we will get into all of that. And we also have an interview today. We talked to one of the stars of the 2-0 New York Atlas. Xander Dixon joins the pod today to talk growing up in a lacrosse family, in a sports family, coming to play the game, getting to UVA, adapting his game for the college level, for the pro level, playing with a team that is now basically the hottest team in the PLL, and a whole lot more. We didn't know all that, so let's not waste any time. Let's do it. Welcome back to Sticks In. My name is Dan Arestia. I am glad you're here. Opening week in the books from Albany, from the PLL. It's crazy how quickly the season just kind of arrives and is upon you. League opens up in Albany. Four games up there at Tom Mary Casey Stadium on the beautiful campus of Albany University. Following a week of training camp there. This has been the practice for years now. And I think it's one of those relationships. I guess you call it a relationship, whatever, an arrangement, a deal, whatever it is. But it's what the league and the school have built it, and it makes sense. It's become this kind of solid, just tradition. PLL, you know, we're in year, whatever this is, year six, I think. You're talking now you're starting to talk, about building your history. Not everything is necessarily new anymore. But you're starting to kind of build some tradition, some longstanding things that is just how things work. Things that have just kind of become a part of the functioning of the league on a regular basis, part of the story of the league. And one of those things is training camp in Albany. It's not because it's some kind of like, we're trailblazing sports or groundbreaking, new, you know, paradigm shifting, whatever your corporate buzzwords are, crazy thing. It's just because it works well. It's because it's a pro sports thing. Albany's a good host. The fans in the region show up. They support the games. The players I've talked to have had good things to say about Albany as a host university to me. I mean, I'm sure there's probably some guys who would make a change, whatever. But by and large, it seems like things just work really well. League's got a good partnership. There's good facilities. The guys are happy to be there. They get a week together. A lot of guys say it's just like summer camp. Everybody's been happy to kind of be around their teammates, to meet the young guys. It works. The region, the league, there's a nice partnership that's just kind of happened there. The same way teams or leagues from the big four sports have relationships with places where they go for spring training or training camp or whatever in the NFL and MLB, whatever it might be. All the way those leagues do that, PLL goes to Albany. You know, showing up, I like that the PLL, as I said last week, shows up in the big brand at 18-wheelers to the place that's always where we have camp. Just optically, it's like this is... It feels like we've always done it, and it's been around forever. And as you're competing for eyeballs and competing for people to take you seriously, like a real pro league, having this thing that feels like the way that's always been, like, oh yeah, PLL's back, they're in Albany, look, they're there every year. They're there every year feels like it's been forever. Feels like it's been more than the 6 years the PLL's been around. I like that. I like that that's kind of how things have gone there with the Albany thing, so... Training camp for a week before the season starts every year. I love that. I do have aspirations, personally, to go to Albany for the duration of camp and try to cover it. Spend a week up there in Albany, getting to, I'm sure, have plenty of good food to eat, which is always important to me, but try and cover PLL training camp in a way that I think would be fun to try and cover it. So, you know, we kind of talked about training camp. We kind of talked about rosters and stuff, some of this already before the weekend last week. So let's just get into some games. Let's talk some games. First game of the weekend was the championship rematch. That's how you start things off, man, on ABC. Archers, Water Dogs, much ballyhooed. It had the window dressing of being Bill Tierney's debut on a pro lacrosse sideline. I will say, I record this here on Tuesday night. The rating number I saw from Sports Media Watch for the game was 420,000 viewers, which is down from last year, but PLL had a really tough competitive window for this game. The UEFA Champions League final, so Dortmund and Madrid, if you're a soccer person, was on during this window. It was later in the window, but it was on during this window. They both didn't start at whatever, at 1 o'clock, but PLL did basically directly compete with a WNBA window here, and that's hard. That's hard. I know it's like... I realize that this is just like a... I don't want to venture into these waters, these take waters, and start doing this whole song and dance, but whenever you talk about lacrosse and it's competing with the WNBA, you're inevitably going to get... You talk about women's sports in general on social media, you're going to get the trolls, the they can't beat women's sports. Come on, nobody watches women's sports. Blah, blah, blah. Like, you need to open your eyes, folks. People watch women's sports, particularly the WNBA. It's exploding right now. The PLL was up against the first professional meeting of Caitlin Clark and Angel Reese. So an Indiana Fever, Chicago Sky game. Every time Caitlin Clark is on TV for the WNBA, she sets some kind of ratings record. So, look, that game drew little over 1.5 million viewers at the same time. And I know as you're sitting on the couch as a lacrosse fan, you're going to be like, of course I'm going to watch lacrosse. I'm not going to watch women's basketball. Not everybody makes that choice. 1.5 million people decided to watch Caitlin Clark and Angel Reese. And if you're the owner of, say, a sports bar or a restaurant, and you can read the news, and you know what people are watching right now, it's Caitlin Clark and the WNBA. In a big way. In an explosive way. WNBA has been on an upward trajectory for years, but it has launched into overdrive this season. And if I owned a bar, I'd put that on. That's what people want to watch. It's probably what people were asking to watch. So you kind of lose some numbers there. It's a tough, it's, I know people like to be weird and stodgy and old school about it and be like, women's sports, please. Just, you can't think that way if you want lacrosse to be serious. It's who lacrosse competes against. And right now, Caitlin Clark draws a lot of eyeballs. So it was not easy to kind of beat the WNBA in that broadcast window, but the game I still thought was okay. It got off to kind of a rough start. And I think people may have expected that a little bit. Because, as you know, as we saw in training camp, Coach Tierney let Alex Stathicus go. He released him, explaining that Stath will be back with the team. He'll re-sign him eventually. He didn't expect him to be claimed by anybody else because everybody else has a specialist already or is a team that won't use one. And Stathicus had to go back to school to finish his master's. So whenever Stathicus is done, you have to imagine he'll be back with the Water Dogs, and they will go with a face-off specialist. But they didn't have one in this game. And if you're going to not have one, it's, I guess, not the end of the world to not have one against Mike Sisselberger, who you probably don't anticipate doing a whole lot of winning against anyway. But the Archers, it's not just, and it's the same story as last year, it's not just the Sis wins them, it's that they're so good in the 32. They were so good in the 32 last year, because Sis always goes forward. Even if you make him exit backwards, he's just too strong and too, you know, too good at like turning a corner to make him actually go backwards. He just turns upfield and the ball's still in the offensive end really quickly. And with no pole out there to really try and turn him back, like, forget it. So the Archers are still great in the 32, which is, again, going to be just a problem against Sisselberger all the time. But the Archers were all over the Water Dogs early. Some of it, I thought Dylan Ward did not get out to a great start in this game. I think he finished sub 50% for the game, in the 40s somewhere. Like, he had a better second half, but, you know, not a great game from Dylan Ward to start, for sure. There were a couple that looked like saves he usually makes that he didn't make. And then the Archers are the Archers, man. They're the defending champs. Like, they're going to play really well. The Water Dogs, they battled back. I know it, like, at one point it was like 12-4, and I was like, frankly, that WNBA game's looking pretty good right now. Maybe I'll flip over to watch Caitlin Clark. would have made it just in time to see her get decked by Chicago Sky player. But anyway, at 12-4, things looked a little dicey. But the Water Dogs battled back. They battled back. They scored the game's last seven goals. Like, they made it 12-11 final. From 12-4 to 12-11 is, that's some fight, man. That's, I guess, a Bill Tierney team fighting. But Water Dogs, look, they got goals from, I think, eight different players. They got a point from nine different players. And Thomas McConvey didn't have a point in this game. He only had seven touches. So, you know, that kind of is the Water Dogs formula, or was the formula last year, too. They beat you with a lot of people with versatility, with guys who can move around and try and just find matchups that work and then take that matchup to a place where the defender is uncomfortable and attack it. I think you saw some of that. I thought Sowers had honestly one of his more poor shooting days. I think he went 1-for-10. So you don't get too many of those kind of days from him. Some of this, look, the Water Dogs took 51 shots in this game. They outshot the Archers 51-36, or 35, I think. The difference in this game is Brett Dobson. 23 saves. 23. If he makes 21 saves, they lose the game. Think of that. Think about how well Dobber played. 23 saves, just under 68%. That's the difference right there. And that comeback fast and furious is again held off by Dobson, who had to make two or three great saves at the end of halftime. And I think he had to make more at the end of the game. Like, he was making clutch saves in this game all the way through it, regardless of what the scoreline was. So I think if you're watching this game, if you're an Archers fan, you're coming away thinking, man, my goalie is pretty damn good. My goalie might be the best goalie in the world. And you probably are a little bit worried that you couldn't quite step on the throat in that game and put it away, and you let a Water Dogs team rattle off seven straight against you. That probably doesn't feel too good. If you're the Water Dogs, you're saying, look, we don't quit. We really look a lot like the same team. We ran into a hot goalie, and it happens. It happens. It's the PLL, man. If the other two teams' goalie makes 23 saves, he makes 23 saves. Maybe you want some of those shots back, ones you thought made it too easy for him, whatever. If he makes 23 saves, it's tough to win. So that was kind of my takeaway from that game. You know, I was happy to see it kind of become a game later. Water Dogs, you know, it wasn't all at once. There was this slow burn back into the game, which was like, something's happening. I think this is pretty good. But Archers end up winning it, 12-11. They go to 1-0. Water Dogs go to 0-1, and the Water Dogs have the bye this week. They don't have a game in Carolina, so they get an extra week to think about this and maybe shooting a little better or figuring out kind of what the problem was. Maybe it's another week for them to get staff back if they want to try and go with the face-off specialist. The teams without a face-off specialist didn't win a game this weekend, so I don't know if there's enough data there for you to really take anything from that or from the rule change, but I know just anecdotally watching. My thing with the prevent last year was, and I harped, if you listen back to me, you go back to my takes from last year, you'll see I was consistent with this. I firmly believe the prevent only really worked if you made the other specialist, if you made the faceoff guy go backwards. If he had to go backwards all the way into his arc or into his goalie, ideally, and clear it, you ate up enough clock for the offense to look like crap and they couldn't get a good possession. But if a faceoff guy could exit flat on the line or go forwards, teams were still pretty good. You could still get a decent shot off. You could create an opportunity. You know, was it the most efficient offense in the world or as efficient as a 52? For everybody except the Archers, no. But it wasn't horrible. The prevent wasn't like a surefire thing if the faceoff specialist was exiting forwards. What you saw without poles out there is it's a lot easier to go forwards. It's a lot easier for Sis to go forwards if Eli Gobrecht isn't the one across from him using a pole to turn him back. Those things that's where the pole kind of, I think, made a difference, is where these exits happen can change. And you saw some faceoff guys scoring goals. Baptiste had a goal this weekend. I think Weirman had a goal this weekend. You know, or at least some shots. Guys were able to go forward and kind of create instant offense a lot easier without the pole there. So the prevent, I think, is still an option. It's just harder to execute because it's harder to make guys exit backwards, and then even harder still to keep them moving backwards. And I think, I still think that's the key to the whole thing, is you have to keep them going and clear the ball, you know, full field-ish, three quarters of the field-ish, to eat enough clock for it to be meaningful. Otherwise, it's really hard to do it. If they still sub on and they got all their guys on and there's, you know, 22, 24 seconds left, then your prevent didn't accomplish much. So I think that'll be something to watch. I would imagine, you know, the Water Dogs, I don't know Stathicus's timing or when the Denver trimester ends and when he gets his degree and all that, when he's done. But I would think that the Water Dogs probably try and have a face-off guy for their week three matchup. The second game on Saturday, we got the first chapter of a classic geographic rivalry, New York and Boston, and it kind of played like one. This game was physical. This was rough. Pushing and shoving, some hard checks. The Cannons have look, I love the guys on that team, and I love Coach Holman and everything, but they're getting the rep of a team that kind of plays that way, of a team that pushes the envelope a little bit with the physicality and the hits and that stuff. That's kind of their rep now. They're earning a rep like that, I should say. It kind of happened towards the end of last year. Definitely, they added to it some in the championship series. And now there were some hard fouls out there, some hard hits out there. And it looks like they're a team that kind of likes to play that way. So I think you got a flavor of that in this one. Some of it is New York-Boston. Does that rivalry really mean anything in the PLL? Probably not really yet. But the play that you got in this game is the way it kind of starts. But rather than listen to me just talk about this, let's hear about it from a guy who had himself a day on the field for it. He had a hat trick in this game. He had another hat trick a day later against the Whipsnakes. He has taken a step as a seriously elite off-ball weapon as a pro. And he looks like a spectacular match with Jeff Teat and his UVA teammate Connor Schellenberger. Here is our interview with Atlas attackman Xander Dixon.
Ready to pop the question and take advantage of 30% off? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com to get 30% off select lab-grown diamonds. That's BlueNile.com for 30% off lab-grown diamonds. BlueNile.com.
Passion, drive, and patience. The formula for winning championships is also what keeps your ride or die alive. eBay Motors has everything you need to maintain your vehicle and level it up to peak performance. Superchargers, roof racks, exhaust kits, LED headlights, and more. Whether you're into speed, power, or style, eBay Motors has you covered. With over 122 million parts for your number one ride or die, you'll always find exactly what you're looking for. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, your part is guaranteed to fit your ride every time or your money back. Because with eBay Motors, you're burning rubber, not cash. With all the parts you need at the prices you want, it's easy to make your car the MVP and bring home huge wins. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply. See ebaymotors.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
All right. Joining the Sticks In podcast now, former UVA All-American, second round PLL draft pick, fourth round NLL draft pick. Some people might not realize that, but elite scorer, elite player representing Southern Connecticut at the pro level, Xander Dixon. Xander, thank you for joining me today.
Thank you for having me on, Dan. Appreciate it.
Noted there, obviously you are from here. We're kind of from the same region here in Connecticut in Fairfield County. Tell me a little bit about your introduction to lacrosse here in Southern Connecticut.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, Greenwich is a big lacrosse hotbed. I think Fairfield as a whole and Connecticut as a whole, you typically think of Maryland, Long Island, and I think Connecticut's definitely in the mix there. So from as early as I can remember, I think I had a lacrosse stick in my hands, was playing competitively against guys who are still playing to this day. So I think I was lucky enough to grow up there where I just had elite level lacrosse around me at all times, and always just making me better and getting to play with my friends and my brothers and sister. So just lucky.
Yeah, you have quite the family. I don't even know if you know this, but I have crossed paths with your family on the lacrosse field before. You have your older brother David, obviously went on to a great career at Bucknell and a quick stint in the pros, but he was at Greenwich High School while I was coaching at Darien, so I had to deal with him at the top of the scout for a couple years there. And then you have another brother, Marshall, who played at Bucknell. And one of my first years coaching in the club circuit, I had a youth team that had a kid named Marshall Dixon on it. I got to coach your brother. So you also have your sister, Amy, at Cornell. I believe your dad played tennis collegiately. You playing squash at Brunswick. It sounds like just sports around the clock in the Dixon household. What was it like growing up like in a family that seems so sports centric, sports crazed?
Yeah, I mean, it definitely was. You nailed it. It's nonstop, 24/7, and still to this day, I think growing up, it was like just how we sort of got along, how we interacted. We're all pretty close in age, but like we're each around 2 years apart. My brother and I, Marshall, are about 3 years apart, but that was always sort of less like the go-to clue. Like you get home and it was like, all right, are we practicing hockey and like on like the driveway, or are we playing lacrosse in the backyard or wherever it was? It was just like, it's kind of just what we did and kind of what we knew and how we bonded. So I think, yeah, it hasn't stopped to this day, but now that we're all a little older, it's more like pickleball and paddle. So just slow down, less contact, but
yeah, much more casual games. You can have beers while playing those. Those are a little bit.
Exactly. Different. That's what we go for.
And I mean, it sounds like, is there anything that wasn't competitive? It seems like the kind of house where even like the walk to the bus stop was a race. Like, you know, like it seems like you guys would compete about everything.
Everything was, and still to this day, is a competition. My parents had used that against us when we were young to do like chores. They'd be like, I bet you can't clean up your room faster than Marshall did it. He did it in like 36 seconds. And they knew that. I'd be like, oh, yeah, like watch. And I'd just run around cleaning it up or something. Like they just knew that was our tick and that we're still like that. So, yeah, it came from my parents and them. And then it's just in our blood now, I think.
And it sounds like you said you're still playing kind of the racket sports a little bit. How old were you, do you think, the first time you beat your older brothers in these things? Like, I can't imagine there ever being a situation where they actually, like, would let you win as the youngest. Like, nobody's ever getting allowed to win. What was that first time, like, beating your older brothers and stuff?
It's funny. I don't really remember, but they all kind of – I hit a growth spurt and I repeated, and they all kind of have a story where they remember, like, that I kind of became either – taller than them or beat them their first tennis match, and like they kind of saw that it was no turning back now that I'd grown up a little bit and was ready to compete. So I don't remember. I mean, I took down my oldest brother David a few years back. He's a really good tennis player. Him and I kind of go back and forth trading matches, but I can get in his head a little bit being an annoying little brother. And then my brother Marsh and I have really good matches too. I kind of just take the net on him and have lanky arms and he hates it. And then my sister is a beast. She holds her own in everything. Like you would think that she would not really be able to compete. She's a lot smaller than us, but no, she's so competitive. She hangs with us. And I think like growing up, she would only want to play on the guys' teams because she just wanted to like hit in hockey or wanted to like play fast paced stuff. So she definitely handled her own, but I don't know when, but I hit a growth spurt and I kind of let them know.
And so, you know, you come up obviously through the high school here, you go to Brunswick, which is a national power. It's every year. They're not just, you know, the top team in the region, but they're a team that battles basically for the top spot in the country every year. Playing for Coach Bruce there. I know Coach Bruce a little bit, but how would you describe his coaching style and kind of the way you fit in there to those teams at Brunswick? There are guys on that Brunswick team that you were on that are, you know, were D1 All-Americans or guys who could be playing pros right now. That team was, your senior year there was pretty unbelievable.
Yeah, we had a crazy talented locker room when I was there. I mean, I've known Bruce since I was young because of my brother and stuff. So we'd always be talking when I was in like youth lacrosse and stuff, and I'd go to all the games. So we have a really good relationship. And he's a UVA alum, so that even strengthened even more. But he was awesome with me. I think he knew coming in, I kind of had a little bit of pressure with my brothers to like fill in their shoes. And he kind of would always address that head on and just make sure I was ready to go and not too nervous or not overthinking things. And I think he just lets the players play. I mean, you touched on our roster was just loaded with D1 All-Americans. I think you tweeted about it a year ago or something when we were in the tournament. And there was like 10 of us that were in the Final Four. Like it was a really, really talented locker room that just goes to like Greenwich Youth Lacrosse and how much they're putting into, how much an effort they make in their youth programs and stuff. And I think it was just like he knew what we had in locker room. He kind of let us do it. He put in simple stuff and just let the players make plays. And I think we came together that year and then all my 4 years there. But Yeah, I mean, he was great. He was great with all of us, and he definitely knows the game in and out, and he's been doing it for a while now, so kudos to him.
And then you get, I'm sure he was thrilled that you made the decision and you end up going to UVA. You have your first season there. You play within that offense there that was also absolutely loaded. You're plenty of the guys on that team, I think, are in the PLL now. You win a title there. Was that sort of the start of Xander Dickson as off-ball weapon Xander Dickson? Because I remember watching you at Brunswick and you were, you know, you could play at X. You were a Dodger. You kind of started the offense there a lot more. And then you get to UVA and you're like, you know, we have all these guys. You're going to be this off-ball weapon.
Yeah, we were laughing about that this week at training camp, actually, with Docs and Connor and Corms. Like, I didn't want to be an off-ball guy. I came in, I was kind of like an X, like you said. I was like Connor, but in high school, but not as good, clearly. But, like, I was an X-dodging quarterback. I'd typically have a couple more assists, and I had goals. And then when I got to UVA, I was like, oh, God, Matt Moore. Oh, God, Connor Schellenberger. I was like, these guys are good. I got to figure something out. I think for my first few years there, I stuck with it, and I was like, I can be this X guy, but I'll do it from the midfield. And they would let me invert a little bit, and I'd get some runs here and there. And then I realized, I was like, God, like, I really, really want to play, be a big role on this team. Like, what should I do? And I saw Ian Laviano leaving, and I talked to Sean Kerwin, who's just nothing but the best things to say about him and his mind and how he sees the game. And he was an inside guy, and he was like, I kind of saw Laviano leaving. I was like, someone needs to do that. And a lot of guys still didn't want to adapt and really do that, because I think when you are an X-dodging attacker, when you have the ball on your stick, you want to keep doing that. But I was like, I'll do it. And I just kind of sat with him and learned everything there is to know about finishing and cutting and drawing slides and you cut and opening up lanes and, like, sort of a world I didn't even know existed. But Sean Kerwin knew everything about it, and he kind of just imparted all of his knowledge on me and all of his wisdom. And I was like, all right, let's do this. Like, I'll, if that gets me on the field, if that helps the team, I'll do it. Like, I don't care. I don't need the ball. Like, I'll clearly not as good as Connor, so we'll let him do that and I'll take the off ball. And then from there, I just kind of dove head first and was like, all right, this is what I'm going to be and going to try to be the best I can. So kudos to Kerwin for convincing me to do it. And Cormier and I still joke that we're not just off-ball guys, even though we know deep down that we are. But yeah, he really got us to buy in. I'm glad he did.
Yeah, you know what? And it's like, that's interesting. You know, I talk about this sometimes with other guys who are looking at high school players and looking at them, you know, projecting them for the next level and stuff. And, you know, for some guys, I think there's this idea that, like, look, if you're going to UVA, obviously you're a special and you're a talented player. And for a lot of guys, you were probably like the superstar on your team who, like, drove the offense and did everything. But not everybody can do that on the same team together. Mm-hmm. And that's what it's like at UVA. So the guys who can make that transition and are comfortable doing it and want to do it, obviously, like, you know, are successful like you were. But there's also, I feel like the same kind of thing happens when you go from college to the pros, where, look, a lot of these guys who are going pro are, they're the, you know, they're attackmen who are quarterback kind of guys, or guys who have the ball a lot. And not everybody can do that at the pro level. And it seemed like you were, you know, just well situated to make that leap, not once, but twice, to do it from high school to college and then from college to pros.
Yeah, I was definitely fortunate enough where there, well, we had Eric Law last year, so they kind of told me from the beginning that I was going to be more of a dodging midfielder. So I was like, all right, I got to click back a few years and, like, what did I know then?
Yeah.
And I was fortunate that I had that background and I played both. So I kind of can dip into each and dip into what I've learned and know from both styles of play. But yeah, I mean, I tell UVA guys now, I talk to, who are trying to get on the field, and we'll have phone calls and stuff with my good buddies. And I always say the message you just shared, which is like, it's a talented locker room. Like, you have to be able to adapt if you want to play. Like, you can't, sometimes it's, some guys it's ego things. They want to stick to their guns and say, I can do this. Sometimes people just don't want to switch, but you have to be able to adapt, I think. And whether you're going from high school to college or college to the pros, like, there's guys who are better than you everywhere at certain things. Like, you have to be able to be sort of a chameleon and know a little bit about everything. I think it really helps.
Yeah, you know, and I'm glad you mentioned there playing with Eric Law, because I think, especially this past weekend, I think you saw some of, kind of, you know, Eric was obviously out with an injury, but you're in there and you were playing kind of a similar role to what we've seen he does, which is, you know, he's around the crease. He's sometimes behind the goal, but he's also kind of an off ball, you know, he's an off ball threat. He's a scoring threat, but it's like just this kind of, the way he moves around the net in particular and just finds these open areas is otherworldly. So what has it been like to you to kind of learn some of that game from him as you kind of developed as this off-ball player? You know, what was it like to learn from Eric, one of the best to do it?
It's been amazing since day one. And even this weekend, it was awesome having him on the field. It was injury, like, he was just, we're talking every time at huddle, what are you seeing? I was like, what are you seeing? Like, we would just trade thoughts, and we joke all the time that we're just the same. Like, just, we have the same mind. So in practice, a lot of times we'll both flash the exact same spot and be standing on top of one another, and we'll kind of laugh at each other and be like, God, what? One of us has to think differently. That we can't, like, it happens every couple of drills. We're thinking the exact same thing. So it's really funny to work with him and study him. I mean, he's one of the guys, when I did become an off-ball guy, I would watch. I'd watch him. I'd watch Westberg. I'd watch Gaudette, and I would just sort of study them. So getting to join up with him and just talk and share ideas with him is awesome. And it's just really funny how similar we are as lacrosse minds. So it's been a blast.
And it's just funny that it worked out that you are now there on weekends, still catching passes from Connor Schellenberger, just doing it in a different uniform. Obviously an awesome start to the season for you guys this weekend, 2-0 on the weekend, you know, matches the win total from last year. You don't need me to tell you that last year, I'm sure could have gone better for you guys, but it felt like, you know, both ends of the field, all phases, like the Atlas just looked great this weekend. Did things feel different around this team in training camp, like coming into this week? Did it just feel like a some kind of difference in, you know, for lack of a better word, in the terms of the vibes?
Yeah, I think it definitely did from the moment we got there. I mean, we definitely made a ton of changes to the roster, but also I think a lot of the core guys had like 9 months to just think about what just happened. And we had a couple of close games that would all kind of, we'd lose control of them late in the fourth, or I think we took the Archers to overtime, would have been a huge like change for our season, and then we lost it. And just guys were bummed and guys were upset and guys came in sort of pissed. And I think our leadership did a really good job of setting the tone from day one. Like, we're competing. Like, our locker room right now is crazy talented, like all the way through 25, 30 when we got to camp. Like, no spot was really safe. And I think last year we weren't as talented, but now it's like everyone was competing as hard as they could for every single rep. And I think that really helped us. And then honestly, in the Redwood scrimmage, we didn't do great, but there was still sort of a quiet confidence. Like, just look around. Like, I know every locker room in the PLL says that, and they are also talented, but we just looked around. We're like, we're going to be able to put this together. We just have to like get the pieces to click. And I think come game day, we really did. But then the second game, we were pretty tired and banged up, so we might have been a little nervous, but just leaning back on like guys like Jeff Teed and just being like, just get Jeff the ball and something good will happen. So it was just a blast and a whole different feel to the locker room last year.
Yeah. You know, and I wanted to ask you about the physicality and the feeling of the quick turnaround. You guys are the first team to have to do it as the first hometown team, the two games in 2 days. Physically, how were you guys feeling coming into the second day?
Honestly, not great. I mean, it's funny. We were watching film and we could hear the commentators when we got off to a hot start saying, oh, it's just they still have the adrenaline left from the first game. We were like, no, like that is not, it may look like that, but that's not how we felt. We had warm-ups. We went back to the locker room warm-ups, and I think Trevor said he loved the warm-ups. The guys looked loose and everything. I think we were just tired. Like, I think everyone's, I mean, we lost Connor. We lost, I forget who else we lost, but guys went down with injuries. Like, the Boston game was as physical as they come. There were fights. Like, there was a lot of hacking, a lot of big checks. I think guys were banged up, but guys kind of bought in, and Coach Presser kept saying, like, no excuses. This isn't, he always says 48 full. He says this is 84 full or whatever it is.
Yeah.
Like, we just knew that the job wasn't done and that we had to just kind of buckle down one more time. And I think we didn't feel great, but we got it done. So we're really pumped about that, honestly.
Yeah. Yeah. No Connor and no Costabile was playing, but was playing, yeah. Playing on one leg. He was not moving great.
Yeah. Yeah. He was banged up. We were talking the night before with my roommate, and I was like, how's it feel? And we looked at it and it was the size of a softball, but he buckled down, altered his game a little bit too, adapted and just grinded it through, which is huge. Cause we didn't really have the numbers to replace him in that moment. So it was awesome that everyone just sort of bought into day two.
Yeah. And I mean, you get that. You also get the performance there from Dylan Malloy, who steps in for Connor, and it's like, and whatever, in the first 2 minutes of the game, takes it to Zapatello and puts a shoulder into him and scores like the most Dylan Malloy possible goal, where he just, you know, just moves a guy with his body and then shoots right through him.
We love that. We've been calling him Thumper, and Coach Presser calls him Thumper because that's the style he plays. And like all week he was doing that, and he kept saying, I'm just doing this and waiting for Connor to get here. And we're just laughing about it. He's hysterical about it. But we kind of knew, like, we're like, when Connor decided he was out, we went to Malloy and we were like, no one was really worried about that. We're like, he's Dylan Malloy. He won a tour and like, he still has it. We've been playing amazing all week. And then just for him to do that right away in that first game and just remind everyone of his style of play. And I think they switched the matchup pretty quick, and they're all They're both amazing defensemen, but just the play that Dylan does, like his arms are bruised up week in, week out. You ask him to just swing the ball to the backside and he goes through three guys. And he's just, it's so much fun. So we were super pumped that he did that, put that play.
So yeah, I mean, obviously you guys win that, guys. You guys also basically destroyed the Cannons. I know you said it was a rough game and everything, but even afterwards, I think Coach Holman had said something to the effect of like, they kicked our butts all over the field. I know it's tough because it's like, it's game one, it's week one, but you have to allow yourselves to celebrate like a little bit out of this, right? I know you don't want to get too high because it's the start of the season, but it has to feel pretty good to have that kind of weekend out of the gate.
It feels amazing just because we're obviously the first team to do it, but I can't imagine it's the doubleheader is going to be easy for everyone. So to come out of there 2-0 and to match our win total from last year, we had beers in the locker room right away, right after the game. And we were just, everyone knew, everyone was like, you don't see a lot of margins like that in the first game. I think we won by like 7. Like that doesn't happen. I was telling Connor, I was like, that doesn't happen a lot. Like it happened a lot to us last year, but we weren't great. But scores like that aren't that common in the PLL. And I feel like everyone's kind of looking around like, whoa, like we might be really, really dangerous. We might be like one of the teams to beat here. And then also we didn't have two of our top three draft picks. So that's like, oh my God, like what is our potential? So I think everyone is super excited and super fired up with how that all went.
Yeah, you guys have a plus 11 goal differential through two games. It takes teams usually most of the season to reach that number.
Yeah, no, it's not lost on us how important that weekend was and that a hot start like that, but definitely not getting like too high on it. I mean, like, guys, this is still the PLL. Like, everyone is going to give you a really good game, and it's not over yet, but definitely excited for now.
Yeah. So 2-0 on the weekend. You guys had two games, like you said, because you were the hometown team. You are the New York Atlas now. Could you feel a hometown vibe? Like, I know the teams have supporter sections now and stuff like that. I wasn't there, so I didn't get to like see the stands in person or whatever, but could you feel kind of hometown support to it? Was it different in any way?
I mean, yeah, first off, the way they decked out the stadium was really, really cool to walk out, and our logos are painted on the hill and the flags are flying New York and there's bulls everywhere and just blue. And then, yeah, I mean, you looked at the crowd, like there was a sea of blue in our section. And every time we scored, you'd hear them. And they had Atlas flags and everything and jerseys everywhere. Kudos to the PLL. They made it feel like a really, like a home game difference. Like it was amazing. I think there were fans there for everyone, but it definitely felt like the Atlas fans showed out a little more than the rest. So it was sweet.
Does that kind of thing feed you in that doubleheader? Like in that second game, is there moments there where you are feeding off crowd juice, especially as you get out to whatever, a 7-0 start?
I think so, yeah. I mean, I think we needed everything we could get that second game because we were tired and banged up. So, yeah, I think it definitely helped. Like, even Sunday they showed out and they were loud and they were right on the field, like right on the edge of the seats. So, yeah, it was awesome and we appreciated that a lot. It felt like a true home game for us.
And so now, you know, we're midweek. You're going to have your team Zoom call this week and then, you know, you got practice and everything. But if you go on DraftKings today, the New York Atlas are now the odds on favorite to win the PLL after 1 week. That was the reaction to what you guys did. How do you address that as a team? Do you even mention it? Do you even acknowledge that that's where you guys are now? Or do you think you have to play like there's a target on you?
Yeah, I think I heard that we went into both games as underdogs and now we're the favorite.
You did. You went into both games as underdogs and now you're going to win the league.
I mean, yeah, it's not like, definitely, I think everyone at this level has like been through these things and they kind of are, you kind of know in the back of your head, don't be arrogant about it. Don't let it get to your head. Like we know how to handle it and not get too overexcited. But I think so for now, it's just like people are like pumped. I mean, we went 2-9 last year, 2-10. Like it was not a very fun time in the locker room after certain games. We'd just be down trying to figure out what to fix. So people are pumped, but people know that it's two games and that everyone, there's no easy game in the PLL. Every roster is insane. But for now, people are excited. People are juiced. Yeah, people are probably going to be coming for us a little more. I remember when we played the Archers last year, like we wanted it a little more, I feel like. But I think everyone's used to games like that. And I think everyone's ready for it and like mature and responsible about it. So I'm not too worried.
Yeah, the margins in the PLL between being at the top of the standings and the bottom are really razor. And the Atlas is a franchise. Are a club that knows something about that. They have been, you know, some of it before your time, I guess, with them, but they have been up, down. They've been at the bottom. They've been at the top and had the turnaround happen in a year. So, you know, the stranger things have happened than saying we just kind of make a couple roster moves and we are one or two bounces better. And that puts us, you know, in the top of the standings.
Totally. I mean, there's just no game in the NPL schedule where you're like, this is going to be easy. Like, everyone has all Americans and every single player on the field. They have tour winners everywhere. Like, there's no game where it's light. So we could be talking 2 weeks from now and we're 2-2 and we're sitting at like the five seed. So we're not, we're not looking past anyone and we're not getting too high on our high horse. We're just enjoying it for now.
I want to ask you too about, I know you're an attackman or a midfielder or whatever, an offensive player, but the defensive side of the field for you guys has changed a little bit this year. You have, you know, new netminder, you have Timmy Trautner who played for you guys this weekend. Liam Enemann obviously gets to camp very late because he was very busy over the weekend. But, you know, you have kind of changes on the defense with no Jack Kincannon, no Tucker Durkin. You've got kind of new guys and roles down there. What has it been like for you in practice or in training camp this past week, you know, going up against that unit that's got as much kind of changing, not necessarily in terms of a lot of personnel, but just moving pieces in it?
Yeah, I mean, it was interesting. It's so many guys I've been familiar with for years, so I didn't, like, it wasn't a crazy change for me. Like, I played against Brett a ton, got to play with Gavin and Rex last year, so I didn't really notice it too much. But I mean, it's a big D unit. Like, they're all kind of meatheads, and they're all got some muscle in them, so it's definitely like you feel it. And I don't play like Dylan Malloy, he probably feels it more, but they looked sharp from day one. I mean, they were cohesive together, and I think putting Brett at LSM last year, he did a great job, but it wasn't his natural position. I think Brett is a stay-at-home defenseman, and that's where he got to go back to that this year and this weekend. So I think he looked comfortable. I think Trautner does a great job talking to them, and he's a great leader in the net with, like, sort of commanding where they go. And then Gavin Adler's kind of just our eraser. Like, you put him on anyone, and he seems – I mean, he was complaining he had to cover Asher and then Zed, and he was like, I'm the smallest guy out here. I got 500 pounds of meat on me. But
yeah. So he was against the Whips too. He was eating picks left and right. The Whips love to throw that pick way down hard on Zed's guy and kind of run him above GLE. And Adler was just getting run into picks the whole first half of that game. I was like, physical weekend.
It's amazing. They're setting picks with big guys too, guys who are hard to get around, and they're going full speed at it. And he had a banged up leg, so he buckled down and did his job once again, like he always does. But yeah, it was definitely. I mean, everyone's talking about the offense. The defense was unbelievable. And Timothy Trautner came out and was just took control and was so good in training camp. And everyone was really impressed. And then two games in net, I think he went 54 and then 58. Like, that's not easy to do. So that was amazing to see.
And then the other thing that's been kind of, I think, a difference, particularly this weekend, is last year we had a faceoff rule change that had the 32-second clock. The Atlas kind of, as a team, struggled with Trevor would win all these faceoffs, but the offense in the 32 either, you know, it took forever to get guys on or we couldn't get good offense. But it felt like over the weekend in both your games that the, you know, Trevor would win his draw and the offense would be ready and get a productive possession out of the 32 more often than not, definitely more often than last year. So, you know, how much did you guys work on that in camp and how much of that was like, you know, something that was on your minds this year as a place to improve?
It was like the number one area to improve for us. I think that really hurt us last year, just not having a set plan. So a ton of the training camp was practicing the 32 and how are we going to be efficient at 32? We have Trevor Baptiste and we have to capitalize on that. So credit to Coach Presser, Coach Understein, and Coach Brooks. They equipped us with like, probably like four or five different plans what to do. But also the hard part is you can plan, you can have these set plans, but you don't know what other teams are going to do. And every team looks at it a little differently. So a lot of it is like reactionary. So they got us ready to go with a few different calls, a few different sets that you saw. You saw some dump it. You saw some go to the net. You saw some put some midfielders back in D, let them run up. We kind of threw everything at people. But I think we also, talking with Jeff, and Jeff kind of said this in training camp where he had a feeling, but pretty quickly in that first game, we were like, we might be fine with just 32. Like, this offense, we might not need the whole 52. Like, we were kind of cashing in on a lot quick. So that was huge, too. Like, we had all these game plans. Whatever we saw them bring out to the faceoff dial, like, we knew what to do. Like, we had a response for whatever we were going to see. And then just the confidence of, like, guys, 32 actually might be fine for us. Like, that is plenty of time. If Trevor can win that four, if Trevor can get it to a wing, like, you have 30 seconds and we have O personnel everywhere and guys in transition. And then Docs did a really good job of just attacking the heart of the defense. He's so big and fast and athletic that he kind of just went right for in both games. And like that worked. And then you have to respect that and then kick it to the sides, kick it inside. Like we kind of hit teams from every angle, I feel like. And so it was just really nice that it wasn't going to be our Achilles heel again. And we were going to be able to capitalize on it and now actually use it to our advantage. So that's a huge relief.
Yeah, and then you mentioned there, you know, Jeff being the person who was like, you know, we might just be fine in 32. I don't know how many PLL fans actually know what Jeff Teat's voice sounds like. Like the guy, in terms of like, you know, him being out there, he can be a bit of a sphinx, I guess, where he's just like quiet and deadly out there. But playing with Jeff, is that like you didn't even know you were open, but the ball is coming your way kind of thing?
Yes, there were. We talk about it every night. Everyone just kind of shares their like, what crazy thing did Jeff do to you today? And we were telling stories, and I was telling Docs that Jeff was at the top of the box and looked at me and gave me a slight head nod from like 30 yards. And I think I rolled around my defenseman and the ball was just in my stick. Like I was looking for it, but I felt the weight and I was like, oh my God, it's already in here. I think I hit a pipe off it, but he just does things that are just like, you can't even describe it. I mean, he had 18 points. The dude, we call him like a wizard. He's just a different level of a player out there. And it's hilarious because you're right. He doesn't speak a lot. He just got this calm presence to him. And then when he does speak, it's pretty much like, let's just play ball, fellas. Like, we'd do a ton of man upsets and like we'd get through our quick hitters and they wouldn't work. And he'd be like, who cares? Just getting a 3-3. Like, let's just play ball. And that's what he does. And he just goes out there and is just smoother, calmer, and better than everyone else, it seems like. So having him is just like the ball's in his stick and you're like, all right, we're fine. Like something amazing is going to happen. And it more often than not, it does.
Yeah, people, you know, as people were watching this weekend, you saw it on like social media. People were like, it looks like he's not trying or it looks like it's just casual, like he's just kind of like jogging and humming the ball around, like it looks like he's not playing at full speed, but it's like it's just because it seems kind of effortless for him.
Mm-hmm. We were joking that no one's ever seen him like sprint because he just doesn't he doesn't need to, like he just gets the job done. And I think this weekend he showed like he did it in every possible way, which is one of the hardest things to do, which you talked about, was like being good at everything. But he is probably the best at like everything. Like it's unbelievable. Like he took Garrett Apple one-on-one a couple of times, scored. His feeding, obviously, everyone knows is unbelievable. His finishing is just next level, like behind the bat, whatever it is. He has the hands for it. He has the indoor. There's nothing – you can't really put him in a box, which is huge, because when certain guys are just beaters, you just stay on their hands, cover the off-ball guys. You're just finishers, like just lock up inside. But you can put Jeff anywhere, and he's going to hurt you. So I think teams are going to have a tough time dealing with him for a while.
Yeah, you talk about his finishing, and it's become one of my – even not, you know, for him, but also for guys like you and for other guys who finish kind of in tight spaces. But I have, I don't know, there's something, a switch has flipped in me where I don't as much get excited about like, oh, that shot was going 110. But I much prefer watching a goalie clearly go the wrong way because somebody has thrown like a head fake or a shoulder fake or has like a great leaner, that kind of thing. And guys like, you know, you did it a few times this weekend. There were a couple where Jeff clearly handcuffed the goalie because they did not know where he was going with a shot, but that kind of thing is like a level of mastery that I think is hard to kind of see sometimes, but when you look for it and you start noticing it, it is special to watch.
I couldn't agree with that more because I think a lot of people don't focus on that. And that's something I feel like a huge emphasis on in my career and learned it from Coach Kerwin, like deception and deceptive shooting and little body language things that a lot of people don't really pay attention to. And I'll do it. But when Jeff does it, it really is like profound how much he did it. And we always say he doesn't shoot over like 70.
No, yeah. Just,
it's crazy. He'll just hit corners and you look at the goalie and the goalie's like crouched on the ground covering his five hole. And Jeff just arcs it in the net like beautifully. And when he does it, and that's cool to be able to talk to him and be like, yo, I noticed you're like doing these little things. Like, how'd you do that? Because I'm trying to do that 24/7 too. And I think maybe it's both of us aren't like the biggest guys. So both of us, we're not shooting over 100 a lot or ever. So we both been emphasis on that. But when he does it, it's just like a thing of beauty.
Yeah. All right. I got a couple of quick ones for you before I get you out of here. Atlas has a lot of personalities in it. Obviously, you have guys like Jeff who are a little more quiet and then guys like Trevor who are not quite as quiet. In that locker room, who gets the aux cord?
That's been a big debate between Docs and myself. And then, yeah, Docs actually just gave me a team fine for bad aux, he said. But so we've been going back and forth, and then Miles Jones takes it, Trevor takes it. But it's currently up for grabs, whoever gets in there first, and then whatever the team's feeling that day. So it's still TBD.
Well, if you're the one who had – what did you get fined for playing? If you got a team fine for bad aux, what got you the fine? What were you playing?
I don't know. I'm trying to appeal it because I said that's music is subjective. You can't say it was bad. That's an opinion. You can't fine me for that. But we'll see if I get it appealed.
Well, I hope everybody, I hope you get a fair hearing in that and you don't pay a fine if it was that bad. Who throws the better feeds, Teet or Schellenberger?
Oh, God. I don't want to upset either one. I need them both. They they play so differently. I mean, I don't know. I'm not picking both of them.
I'm not letting you off the hook. It's a righty and a lefty. So I guess it's kind of like, who do you like getting fed by more? A righty or a lefty? I don't know if that matters to you, but you got to give me somebody.
Who throws the better feeds?
Yeah.
I'm trying to honestly think. Both me. I'll say for week one, Jeff had more success.
Okay. And that was, I like the qualifier for week one.
Yes.
And it gives Connor something to push for in week two here. He's gonna overtake
Jeff. Exactly. Now he has to play.
He's gotta throw you some spectacular feeds all week in week two, so you could be like, I don't know. Now I think it's Connor.
I'm incentivizing him.
I think Docs was pushing 100 on the gun this week, but who would you say shoots the hardest on your team?
It's gotta be Kobe Smith. That guy, he slings it. And it looks so casual to a golf swing. Kobe, definitely Kobe.
Okay. So you, Docs, Schellenberger had a great weekend. Cormier was there with you guys. Once he's, you know, gets everything travel wise sorted out, he'll be with the team. Have you guys started lobbying for Pressler to trade for Matt Moore yet?
No, I mean, we think Coach Pressler likes the Who's right now. We kept joking that we'd leave the locker room, we just come back with another Who. Like, Connor just landed, we grabbed him, brought him in, then we'd leave again, and then Cormier showed up overnight, and everyone was like, you guys just multiplying? So, we're gonna try to get some more. I don't think we need him right now, but more Who's the merrier, I think.
Carolina Chaos this week. You guys played last year in Connecticut. Give me one key to this game to for you guys to deal with the physical defense that Carolina plays.
Yeah. If you asked what I was thinking that the defense is physical and aggressive. Ball movement, the way you break down a defense is just ball movement, especially defense like that that wants to play up in your grill and make it physical, just beat them with ball speed. So that, and then I think Caught will be in that, or Austin will be in that. So ball movement and then smart shooting.
All right, man. I'm going to end it there. I appreciate you jumping on with me tonight, taking a few minutes to talk about the Alice's great start. You guys are off to a good one. I hope it keeps up for you.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on, Dan. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Xander. Good luck in Charlotte this weekend.
Thanks.
Bye. As you kind of heard there, Xander and I are from towns in Connecticut that are near each other. I have I had the interesting connection of coaching his brother Marshall as a middle schooler in the club scene and having to coach against his brother David, who was a stud attackman at the high school level. Dixons really are obviously a great lacrosse family here in Connecticut. Xander's doing the game, his family, the region, proud at the pro level. So I was very happy to get to talk to him a bit about those games, about his time kind of coming up from here to UVA and to the pros and to the field in Albany over the weekend. And turning the page a little bit, back to the weekend, we can go look at some of these Sunday games now. First up, Carolina beat Denver 16-11. This was the very ballyhooed pro debut of first overall draft pick and wonder kid Brennan O'Neill. I guess a couple things here as I kind of was watching the game and started to kind of get rid of thinking about it. But I tweeted before the game about all the different ways that Coach Sudan had said they were using Brennan in camp, two-man games on wings, big littles behind, playing inside, you know, kind of off Zawada at X, running him out of the box, all that. I think it was Jack Hanna who was like, oh, so he's playing offense? I was like, first and foremost, yes, and that's very funny. But it didn't even occur to me to think of it that way. Like, oh, he's just playing offense. And I think it's because after the last, you know, his career, you know, whatever, I felt like whenever I turned on a Duke game, I saw just a ton of possessions where it was like Brennan's on the lefty wing, dodging across the top, looking for a shot, maybe off a pick. But usually it's just Brennan's on the lefty wing. A lot of things for him started there. So I think I was excited to, yeah, see him play more offense, to see him moved around a bit in some other looks, to try and free him up and use him in different ways. And I do think there is a bigger topic here around Brennan O'Neill too, which I might just experience this as someone who's like spent time around other media folks and coaches or whatever, but it feels like everyone has the answer on how you're supposed to use Brennan O'Neill
and nobody's answers are ever really the same. Duke should have done this. The Outlaws should do that. I think Brennan and Duke got Monday morning quarterbacked maybe more than any lacrosse player ever. They should have done this with him. You know, if they had put him over there, they had done this, and everybody's got their own take on it. And I think that's probably just something that comes with the pressure or the privilege or the stature of, you know, the kind of player that Brennan O'Neill is that he's so good and he does so many things. Everybody's like, oh my God, if I had a guy that could do anything, I would do this. Right? It's like finding the magic lamp with the genie in it. It's giving you three wishes. And you're just like, I would wish for these three things. Somebody else is going to wish for something different. Brennan O'Neill is the one granting your lacrosse wishes. And you're like, I would do this. Somebody else would do something different. None of us really matter, though. The answer is, can the Outlaws figure out what to do with him? And that was kind of the rub. I think, you know, they're still trying to figure out maybe the place where he's going to do the best for them. He, of course, is going to say he's comfortable everywhere. And honestly, he probably is. He can do everything pretty well. But I think they're still figuring that out. In 1 week with a basically a whole new offense, 1 week of camp together, you're still figuring it out. I think the team, when you go back and you look at this game, the Outlaws and the Chaos, the team in this game that had more shots, they had more shots on goal than the other team had shots at all, had more ground balls, had more caused turnovers, committed fewer turnovers, had more possession, completed more passes, won more faceoffs, that team lost the game. It does not often happen that way, that you win all of those categories and you lose. Full stop, frankly, I think Sean Scannone played one of the worst games I think you've seen from him in a while. I think he just got off to a bad start. There were plenty in that game that were on the doorstep or were not necessarily shots you would expect him to make at a pro level. If a guy's getting a dunk, he's getting a dunk. It's, you know, not a whole lot Sean can do about that. But there were definitely some that I thought he should have had or that he usually has that he did not have in this game. I did not think he played a great game. I think a roster move this week that the Outlaws made would show you that Sudo might agree with me. You know, he said after the game he didn't think it was Sean's best game. He again also said, look, we didn't give him a lot of opportunities to make saves. There were some dunks and some shots that he was not going to save, but that team also brought in Matt Note this week, UMass goalie, who is outstanding, who I've been very high on since he's been in college, and can push for that job. So goalie position with the Outlaws, something to watch there maybe, but look, at the end of the day, Denver in this game played inefficient offense and had a shitty day in goal. That's all it takes to lose in the PLL. They won every other category you can think of, but they were inefficient on offense and they had a shitty day in goal. It's a rebuild offense in week one. You're going to have bad shots, weird looks because guys are getting used to things. I know they had training camp, but it's still, there's so many new guys there. I think Blaze was hot early. He has the injury. Austin Kauk gets hot late. You're one of the two hot goalies in the same game. It's just not Denver's day. But I really don't think you can look at that game and say, well, Denver's going to stink again. I don't think that can be your takeaway. I don't think that can be how it is. I think they're good. I think they're going to be okay. They let Connor Farrell go today, signaling that Luke Weirman's going to be their guy. I said it on social. Connor Farrell's career over the last year is like to be studied. Because last summer, kind of gets bit by the rule change and can't be in the lineup a lot for the Chrome. Healthy scratched, not really in the mix. The winter comes. Buffalo, the Bandits, can't win a faceoff. They need to figure something out. They sign Connor Farrell. As soon as they do, they start winning games left and right, and they run all the way to a repeat of the NLL championship. They win the title again. So they sign Farrell, they get the ball more, they score more, things go great. And then I'm thinking, all right, Farrell's showing you a little something here indoors. He can bring that outdoors. He gets cut before week two. I don't know. I can't figure it out. We'll see if that's it for Connor Farrell in the outdoor scene or if somebody else wants to take a shot on him with the rule changes. It's tough to know what teams are really thinking at the faceoff spot, but I hope he keeps playing indoors because he really was successful with the Bandits. He seemed like he loved it. He seemed like he was a fit there. I hope he sticks with that. On the Carolina side of this thing, I think it's all going to start and end with the Blaze Virden situation. Coach Towers wasn't available to the media post game, which is unfortunate, but it sounded like he had to leave in a hurry. So we didn't get to ask about what happened, but we did get the report on SportsCenter midweek that Blaze had a patella subluxation, which is like a, basically it means your kneecap kind of slid out of place for a second and then probably slid back in on its own based on the timetable. So it sounds like there is, it's only going to be a few weeks. And that is like the biggest exhale of all time for Towers, for DC Jamie Hanford, for that bench, for that side, that roster, for their fans, for the Carolina community. Your all-world goalie is only going to miss a few weeks. That's good. It sucks because one of the weeks he's going to miss is the week that your team is in town. It's Charlotte week. It's Carolina week for the PLL, and Blaze is not going to be a go. So they're going to be without him. Austin Cowell played his ass off. He is not some schlub. He's also got some personality. Let's just be clear about the fact that this is a goalie of the year from college, was arguably the top goalie in the MLL when they were acquired by the PLL. The Chaos are not in dire straits in goal. They're going to pick somebody up. You know, this is not a situation where you start making trades and getting aggressive and getting nuts. Blaze is going to be out a couple weeks. You'll be all right. The defense in front of your goalie is still awesome. Mike Adler has been with this team in camp this year. He was with the team last year. He's been with the team for a little stretch, I believe, in each of the last three seasons. He knows them well. They know him well. I would be stunned if it's not Mike Adler out of the player pool for a few weeks because he's a guy that they can trust, and he's a guy you can trust to handle the iPad on the sideline and all that the way you need your backup goalie to do it. So I would imagine, look, Kaut is a guy I would trust as my starter in the PLL. Mike Adler makes a ton of sense for them to be back. It's the way teams kind of do this is they have their third goalie. That's the guy. So that'll probably be the move, I think. Offensive end of the field, I thought the Chaos looked sharp. For a first game with a new philosophy and all that, 16 goals, sure ain't bad, man. You know, Ian McKay actually said post-game, being there for camp with the other, you know, the Bandits guys, the indoor guys from jump this year has made a big difference because they've been able to adjust. They've been able to meet the young guys, the off-the-field things of them just being there. You cannot undervalue those. Those are important. It's big-time stuff. I think the first season opener ever that was won by the Chaos was this one. It's their first week one win as a franchise. I don't think that's a coincidence that they have everybody there together for the duration of camp and they win and they come out on the right side of not a close game, but a game that was not, you know, not as much of a blowout as it looked. I thought Ross Scott made some nice plays as a Dodger, scored a couple of goals in this. I think he's another one of those guys where, you know, he and obviously in Malone, but are forever going to be the guys where, you know, down the road, you're like, he went in what round? But in any draft year other than 2024, he's a top round talent. But this is a guy who's playing for Team Canada in the Fall Classic this year, cooking Team USA polls for a hat trick. He can dust you. And I think here's what I like most about it, I think. He and Minikas are basically like for like. So Towers loves to build these teams that are just a bitch to prepare for, that are just really hard to get ready for. With all of his box guys, it was hard to try and get ready for that, to defend that. And now they've changed. Not as many box guys. Things are different, but if you're preparing for this team now, all right, we have to get ready for Ross Scott at attack. Oh, well, this week he's at midfield. You got to get ready for Brian Minikas at attack. Oh, well, this week he's at midfield. They can just swap spots. Henningberg can do that too. With box guys, without box guys, getting ready for the Chaos, preparing for the Chaos just sucks. You got to get ready for all these guys moving around. It's really hard to try and be ready for it all. I'm sure the Chaos staff and the Chaos fans were also very happy to see Sergio Perkovic with a pair of goals in this one. One of them being a two-pointer and on just two shots, efficiently done. I think, look, I'm sure he would tell you he had a forgettable summer last year. And he was definitely a little bit better at the championship series. But I can tell you on those sidelines, among people who were watching, there were people wondering, media folks, lacrosse, you know, pundit kind of folks, if it was time for Sergio, if he had reached the end. But he did not look like that over the weekend. He had 14 touches, I think. No, he had more than that. I'm sorry, I'm reading my numbers here wrong. 14 different players had a touch of the ball for Chaos. 10 of them touched it double-digit times. Ball moved well for Carolina. Last game of the weekend, Atlas whips. I was interested in this because I wanted to see the Atlas manage the doubleheader. And everyone has to play one this year. Atlas got theirs first. I think there's positives and negatives to that. You heard some of, you know, Xander kind of talking about this, how kind of roughed up they were. But look, a positive to getting your doubleheader first, you get it after a week of training camp and practice together. You're organized. You're in a routine. From this point on in the season, it's a Zoom meeting during the week, and players fly in for a walkthrough on Thursday or Friday. And that's it. That's how you get ready to go play. Much harder to prepare that way, let alone for two different opponents in the same weekend. So I think it's a positive for Atlas because you can spend that week together in a routine and have it all fresh to you and ready to go, rather than Wednesday night, Thursday night Zoom meeting, Friday night walkthrough, Saturday game one, Sunday game two. The negative, of course, is you do play two games in 24 hours at the pro level with 19 guys. And as Xander told you, with a banged up 19 guys. That's rough. Pressler used his reserve spots, as we said, to get Malloy into the lineup. Schellenberger was out for the second game. Schellenberger was carrying injuries late in the college season, and he hasn't really had a break. So he sat with a groin injury. The time for him to heal will be huge. And look, Malloy had the impact early. You heard him. You heard Dixon say it. The thumper. About the perfect name for him. With a couple of goals in this one. And that's a tone setter. That's the kind of thing that gets your team juiced. Atlas played the first quarter. Boyle said it on the broadcast, running on adrenaline. Xander, as you heard, kind of disagreed. They were tired. But I think you could kind of see that they had some juice from players like Malloy getting that goal. And like that hot start was just huge for them. They scored on their first seven shots. All seven were goals. I think you very much saw their legs get tired in Q3 and Q4. So that fast start was big. And I think ultimately it felt like they were kind of surviving that game at the end. Costabile being hurt, like they were just making it through. Some of that hot start, I think, frankly, Whips coach Jim Stagnetta took some credit for. He did note that starting goalie Kyle Bernlohr was coaching the team that he coaches in the season in the springtime, the high school team he coaches for their state tournament. And then his flights to Albany were like a disaster. So Bernlohr basically didn't get to practice with them much. So he, as I hear that, what his coach is telling you is that Bernlohr basically just got there and stepped into a pro game cold. And it's tough to be successful that way. But Bernlohr has earned the opportunity to do that. He's earned that trust. So it went that way. You do that again tomorrow, it might not go that way because he's a good goalie. But I thought Krebs played well in relief after the kind of the tough start. I think the big news thing for the Whips is TJ Malone, obviously looking really good in his debut. And Stagnetta said postgame he wanted to make sure that Malone touched the ball on every possession, because when he got it, good things happened. Malone led the team with 6 points. He only committed one turnover, which is pretty damn good for the level of usage he had. 25 touches were tied for the most in the team. No turnover, or one turnover. That's really good. I was not really put off by the Whips' performance. After that awful start, they were good. They were fine. In fact, they might have even been the better team. Some of that, yeah, Atlas fatigue, got it. But they won quarters 2-4 by a score of 12-10. And the Whips are getting used to changes too. New defense. Malone is the key offensive piece. Baptiste is winning draws. I thought Zupacic did play well in place of Michael Earhart. Michael Earhart, he is not yet, but I think that's very much his job. Zupacic is going to be the LSM there. The player in the game with the second most ground balls, obviously Trevor Baptiste has the most, of both teams was Atlas Longstick Mitty Tyler Carpenter. Stole the show on the second day. 6 ground balls, a goal, and a cost turnover. He was a force on those wings. Zupacic going to be fine. Tough first game. But I thought Carpenter was the better LSM in this one. For the Whips, I do wonder about who's going to do damage for them from range. Chanichuk hit a pair of twos in this game. Honestly, some of that is just the Atlas fault. Chanichuk is the only guy on that roster right now who you look at and say he's going to hit a two against us. And their closeouts on him in the second half from two-point range were bad. He hit his second one, and you could hear Trautner just begging his defense, please get out there. Tired legs, I'm sure, a bit responsible for that. But look, it still happens. But you look at this team last year, the guys hitting the twos were Earhart and Dordovic. It'll be a few weeks before Dordovic comes back. Excuse me. Earhart is retired. So is it going to be Ledman who hits some twos? Is it going to be a pole? Is it going to be Zupacic maybe? You didn't get much out of Heacock. There isn't much in the way of range right now on this roster. And if you can't stretch a defense, it makes the job of the help defenders just so much easier on guys like Rambo, guys like Zed. You know, the Whips are great at picking down for those two as they attack upfield towards goal line extended. They were able to switch Zed's matchup a bunch of times. But the Atlas defenders just doubled well on Zed and Rambo, and they're just in position to help right away because they don't have to respect the two-point arc right now. Or against the Whips, you just don't. So, look, I think offense with a new OC, some different pieces, working the kinks out, but the Whips will be fine. This week, coming up, Carolina homecoming. The bye week, as we said, is the Water Dogs. The Chaos will play twice. Their Saturday game against the Atlas was just flexed from ESPN Plus to ESPN 2. I love that. I love that they're going to be on linear in their home market so you can see a home crowd on cable TV because that crowd has always been good to them. I do hope the crowd is able to get there. I saw Ryan Flanagan mention that the start time might be tough for some local fans. I mean, it's club tournament and showcase season. It's going to be that kind of thing. You want to try and get as many kids and players in the stands as you can. You hope I haven't looked at the schedule with those things, but you hope it's not a serious conflict there. But Chaos play twice, that first game on Friday against the Redwoods, and then that second game against suddenly the favorite to win the whole thing, the New York Atlas. It just changes that quick in the PLL. That'll be it today. We'll be back here Friday with a preview show for the weekend, talking through those Friday matchups, those Saturday matchups, getting you ready for everything. If you are the wagering type and you used the spreadsheet that I kept during the college season, I do keep the same exact thing during the pro season for the PLL. If you need that, let me know. You can also see the team's results overall and against the spread, their entire schedules, everything you need to know on the sticksinlacrosse.com site. Thank you again for coming back and sticking around with me. We'll see you next time.
For the ones who know safety isn't a catchphrase, it's a culture. And the ones who help make sure everyone makes it home safe. For the safety-minded who watch everyone's backs, Grainger offers supplies and solutions for every industry, as well as safety assessments and training to keep your facilities safe and your people safer. Call, clickgrainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.